Agent Sonny Jones. If you need a home, call Sonny Jones. She can help you buy or sell your home. A luxury or income property. Agent Sonny is the one that you want to see.
Hi, I'm Sonny Jones, your community real estate partner. Real estate ownership is key to building generational wealth, and it matters who you work with. Whether you're buying or selling, I am here to help you win. Let's chat. You can find me at agentsonnyjones.com, Facebook and Instagram, or by text 323-793-7651. If you need a home, call Sonny Jones. 323-793-7651.
So when you need a home, call Sonny Jones. When you need a home, call Sonny.
Welcome to Slauson Girl Speaks. I am your host, Slauson Girl, bringing you world news with a South Central state of mind. Black and brown relations in Los Angeles is a tricky topic, which is sad because of how close in proximity we live to one another and the ways we have been marginalized in America as we strive to carve out larger pieces of society where we have historically been denied space. When I put on Instagram that I was recording this podcast and asked people what they wanted to hear, there were various comments that really showed how race relations between blacks and Latinos in LA are strained. What people did say they wanted to hear was addressing the bigotry towards both races that happens inside the home. Anti-blackness in the Latino community was another huge one, as well as the usage of the term nigga. Many black people also have a huge issue with the rise of Latinos in Los Angeles workplace and the idea that just like white people, many Latinos don't hire to African Americans. The Latinx community wanted to address the attacks on street vendors by our young black males, which we have seen circulating social media in recent months. This has caused a frenzy on online spaces, especially in Latino-run pages. Comments about kill these niggas and putting people's addresses on social media. Although the attacks on street vendors cannot be tolerated in any way, I won't say although, the attacks on street vendors cannot be tolerated in any way. These attacks, however, reveal many of these anti-black attitudes that are still prevalent in many spaces in the Latino community, which many people reveal are ingrained in them at a young age. I think the problem lies within the fact that both groups view each other sometimes as enemies in the name of upward mobility while fighting for what we view as limited. Another big issue are prison and gang politics that have real effects on the relationships of the black and brown community who are not gang members. We don't have prison experts on this episode per se, or those necessarily from the gang life, or am I speaking for anyone? Okay. So we will just mention this without going too deep. I will have a follow-up interview to really go into those issues with those who are more versed in this subject, as it is very important to touch on. Violence has been a part of our history as black and brown people struggling to survive in Los Angeles, dating as far back as to the 90s for contemporary times, and even probably further back than that for those that have the historical knowledge to talk about that. Many black people point to the acts of black families being bombed in Boyle Heights as Latino gangs work to push blacks out, and to the fact that many black people are scared to travel to East Los Angeles alone. During the rise of street vendor attacks, there have been black and Latino groups that have come together to promote unity, such as the group One Compton. They shot a campaign video to share to social media to promote peace and unity. There was also a black and brown unity march and many black people coming to support the young kid who was shot in Gardena recently by police, Andres Guardado. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Rest in peace. The fact of the matter is there are issues in our communities in Los Angeles that need to be addressed so true healing can happen. Violence and anti is perpetuated on both ends in both communities, so how can we all work together to ensure real change? Today I have the pleasure of discussing these issues with three Black and Brown folks as we envision ways to promote solidarity within both communities. So I would like to take this time to introduce my guest. We can start with Abigail. Tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what your work revolves around.
Cool. So my name is Abigail. I'm the founder and executive director of Color Compton, a nonprofit in Compton. We focus on the history of Black and Brown folks and really building solidarity and community using art as a tool to have these conversations. So a lot of my work really is grounded on this work, so I'm excited about that.
Very nice, very nice. Next we have Memo.
Hey, Tina, how's it doing?
Hey, how are you today?
Good, good. So I'm Memo Torres. I'm with a local publication called LA Taco, where we cover everything from tacos, news, street culture, art, community issues. I write for the site. I do a lot of things for the site. And recently we've been all been very conscious of what's going on in the communities, and we've been writing about it. We actually had Tina write a fantastic article on that recently. That's who I am.
Thank you. And next we have Danny. How are you doing today?
Tina, what up?
Hey.
My name is Danny Carter. I'm a manager in the music business, and I'm the co-founder of Buy Back the Block LA, which is a financial literacy and real estate education group focused on Black empowerment and fighting gentrification.
Definitely. Okay, so I guess we'll get right into it. I want to ask our guest today, how exactly do you guys view Black and Brown relations in Los Angeles? Abigail, would you like to?
Sure. I'll get started on it. I mean, I think that the relationships have a long history, and it's complicated, and it's gone through different, when people are building community with one another, and when people are really kind of against one another. I feel like we've seen it through different generations, like what our youth is doing, what our older generations are doing. So I think that it's complicated. It's very complex. And I feel like we don't talk about it enough. And this cycle just kind of keeps repeating itself because we don't talk about the history. We don't talk about what's happened in the past, how folks have kind of come together in the past, and where the struggles within each communities have really fallen. I feel like we've always tried to flatten the experiences, like Black and Brown folks, we're in the struggle together. And it's true, but what happens is that you flatten folks' experiences. It's not 100% the same. We don't have the same experiences. We're on this like struggle against white supremacy together, but the way that it's manifested in both communities has been different. And I think that a lot of times folks are a little weary to talk about that, you know, because it can get a little uncomfortable. It could get a little bit hard. And I think a lot of the times folks want to skip to like a kumbaya moment, like, you know, we're folks of color, let's just come together and we're one human race. And that can sound great, you know, in a moment in time where we do need to come together. But then what happens after that moment passes? Because certain things weren't addressed, because we didn't do that hard work, that digging, that uncomfortableness that is needed to heal any type of wound, really. And this is like a generational wound. So I think it's the relationship between Black and Brown folk, I feel like, is really complicated. It hasn't been addressed as much as it should be.
Definitely. Memo?
I have a lot of personal experience with this growing up, and with family and with friends and the community. I feel like it goes through waves, you know. I feel like for a while we were, you know, the Black and Brown unity was good for a while, and then recently we had, you know, we had that bombing in Boyle Heights, we had the street vendor attacks, and I think those kind of things open up old wounds that cut deep, you know, and those kind of actions complicate things, you know. And I know I personally, growing up in Inglewood, was, you know, I've been shot at. I've been caught up in like the middle of black, brown, you know, turf wars and gang wars. And I've never been a gang member, but just, you know, being in the community, you know, you witness that and you're, you know, can't fall victim to that. It's like, you know, like you said, it's not anything, you know, simple. It's not black and white. It's complicated. But I do feel though that there's been a lot more black, brown unity recently than when I was growing up, like a lot more. Yeah. Even though it's still not a cohesion, it's still not that kumbaya moment, you know, it's been a lot better. But, you know, deep wounds run deep, and these are things that, you know, get exposed again, and things that we need to go back and talk about, not just forget about.
Definitely. Danny?
Yeah, I think my perspective is probably going to be a little bit different, because I think that the relationship is terrible. I think it's been terrible for a long time. And I think in order to be able to fix it, you know, you got to talk about why it's terrible and be honest about what's going on. You can't try to sugarcoat it, try to watch people's feelings. You got to get in there and clean that wound out if you want it to heal properly. So that's my perspective. I think the relationship is awful at this point.
Okay, definitely. Well, the next question that I had was, you know, what do you feel has complicated the relationship? I know, Memo, you touched on it, I feel, a little bit. Danny, would you like to kind of expound on that? What do you feel has complicated the relationship to the point where in 2020 it's terrible, from your perspective? And from many other black people's perspective, I might add, not to cut you off.
No, you good. You know, I'm definitely interested to hear what Abigail and Memo have to say. I think for me, one of the things that's probably complicated the relationship is, you know, all of this kind of stems from white supremacy as a root. So what they do is they import different groups of people into the country to act as a buffer class between them and black people. And unfortunately, when certain groups of people come here, they start to buy into some of the talking points and narratives and perspectives of suspected white supremacists who bring them here or allow them to come here. And then there's this motion of trying to get closer to the power system, closer to the power base. And that means that you have to learn early in America that you have to distance yourself from black people. You have to get as far from black people as possible, and you have to make sure that you do not emulate any of their behavior if you choose to go the path of being accepted and you want to assimilate. So I think that anybody who's trying to assimilate into America, which is a white supremacist system, is going to be in direct conflict to black people who have always been known to try to topple that system to one degree or another. So I think that that's kind of where it all stems from.
Okay.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I don't think that you could talk about this topic without addressing white supremacy, colonialism, and power dynamics. Because, you know, we've all learned race is a social construct. And I feel like the way that America and colonialism has really driven what blackness is here, what being a person of color is here, is very strategic. And we've seen it very much be correlated with political movements, right? Like, it becomes about government and money and power. So I feel like it's very strategic. And yeah, I 100% agree. We need to start from a point of white supremacy and blackness to talk about any groups of color.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that white supremacy goes back down to colonialism, you know, which is probably has ingrained racism amongst, you know, brown folks, you know, for centuries. Mm-hmm. You know, you go back to like my ancestors, my grandparents and stuff like that. There's deep rooted racism in there that they weren't even aware of. It's just, you know, why we all speak Spanish in the first of all. You go to these small towns, you know, like the whiter, light-skinned, Spanish-looking folks are in the main parts of the town, while like the more native, darker Indian natives, you know, were pushed out to the outskirts of the towns. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this whole idea of like, you know, like always try to like marry up fair-skinned, you know, like it's been centuries of that, you know, in Latino culture, and it's something that people aren't really aware of, you know, themselves.
Definitely. Well, this is actually something that I had outlined to talk about. It was pushed down in the conversation, but since you mentioned it, maybe we should, you know, kind of lead with this. We mentioned the word colonialism. Does anyone want to kind of explain what that is for our listeners?
Well, you know, it's basically, you know, the history of colonialism of, like, you know, white Europeans coming to take over, you know, non-white countries, you know, whether it be from Africa, India, all of Latin America, the Indians, you know, the Indian Islands, you know, basically erasing culture, erasing their history, like literally burning their textbooks, you know, erasing their religions, erasing any semblance of their, you know, of who they are as a people. You know, bringing in their own themselves and, you know, started implementing in their own fair-skinned bodies and procreating and trying to create, like, a more whiter race, you know. And then with that, teaching people that, like, no, these are savages, you know, whiter people are better, they're more intelligent. And that's just continued over the years and over the years. And it's become, you know, part of culture now, you know, for people to feel that way in families.
Definitely. What I find really interesting as somebody that's from the outside looking in, I remember one time I took this class and it was like something about the U.S. and the Mexico border. I think that was like the class. And then we had to learn about all these different wars that had happened along like the U.S.-Mexico border. And so we were like way like in the, I don't know, 1600s or something, you know, but like the further you go back, you start to kind of see the effects of colonialism, the effects of the white folks coming through and taking over sections of countries and just people. And so for me, it was interesting to kind of see how like the Latino community has been colonized and kind of like the origins of like who they really are. In a sense. So who would you say, like, you know, in terms of like the roots of the Latino culture, who are you guys? And when you explain it in the way of like colonialism? I came to understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the Latino community are like mixtures of like Native American people and like Spaniards, people from Spain, because Spain colonized. Mexico. And so when you're colonized, you start speaking the language of the colonizer, so, which is why Latino people speak Spanish.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, even so many parts of Latin America still speak their native tongue. And I think that's another part of like colonialism and erasure of cultures when folks lose their native tongue. Like Spanish is not our native tongue. But I think that that also begins the complexity of like when you go back to them saying black and brown and how what the relationship is, because when we talk about the Latinx community, that's like central and southern and the Caribbean, all of that, and all of those countries have very different relationships with how they were introduced into the U.S. Like Mexico has a very complex history because we're the only I'm Mexican American, but we're the only Latin country that has a physical border with the U.S. And a lot of the land that is now the U.S., you know, there was like war. And so it's a very complex history. We've had a revolving door policies with the U.S. where the U.S. has gone into Mexico and been like, yes, we want you to work here, and then creating the border control. And so it's a very complex history. And then you bring in, you know, like Cuba. That's another complex history. Puerto Rico colonized, but they're not citizens. You know, Argentina being like one of the whitest Latin American country. And so it's so complex. And I feel like when folks get here, then it's like, all right, you need to be flattened down. Now you're a Latinx person in the U.S. And it becomes complicated. And so I feel like what has happened a lot of times is that being Latino now is synonymous with being Mexican, because that's like the highest group of folks that we've seen in the U.S. And then that creates subdivision among Latinos that aren't Mexican. Like what happens to our Dominican brothers, our sisters, and Puerto Rican and Guatemalan. And so I think it gets a little bit complex there. But it's all important to discuss and kind of like dissect, because it's impacted these relationships. It's impacted how folks of color look at each other. And I think the Black and brown relationship in the West Coast is also different than in the East Coast. And it's because of that history, because of, you know, in the West Coast, we have what was previously Mexico. And then before that, just free land, like Native Americans that lived here and was colonized by the Spanish, by the Spaniards. And so I think, I feel like now I forgot where what my point was, but it's just so much, right? Like, mm-hmm. Where do you then say, like, okay, this is what it means to be brown in the U.S. and what this is what it means to be Black in the U.S. and now how are you guys gonna, you know, interact with one another? It's so much history, and it varies country by country how colonialism affected every country, and then how those groups of folks migrated. Like, the reasons why they migrated to the U.S. is also different country by country.
Right. Okay, well,
I can add to that a little bit. I mean, you know, when you talk about brown folks, it's like this, like you say the term flattening, you know, of brown folks. You know, we're not Latinos, brown folks, Hispanics, you know, the broader term. It's so complicated because people forget that Latinos are a mixture of not just Spaniards and Native Americans from that time. It's a mixture of Chinese, you know, mm-hmm. Chinese were imported to Latin America to work, you know, as slaves. A lot of Black people were imported, for, you know, as slavery. A lot of Black people sought refuge in Mexico, you know, from slavery. So you go down to Latin America, you go to Guatemala, you go to, you know, the Puerto Rico, you know, like you said, in East Coast is different. There's a lot more Afro-Latinos than mm-hmm. like you see over here on this side, which is, I think, is a problem that people don't recognize that. You know, the mixture, you know, of different cultures in the brown community, right. You know, which complicates the issue of like, well, what's brown? What's right. Black?
Right.
You know, what's white?
Okay. I have a question, but I just wanted to ask Danny, did you have any thoughts that came to mind during any of the comments that Abigail or Memo made?
No, I'm learning. I'm listening.
Yeah. I like Abigail, I love the way you broke that down. This is a question that I have. Because I was kind of surprised at this fact or idea. At what point did members of the Latino community, like, begin to identify themselves on the census as white?
Yeah, I mean, that was all imposed by the U.S., mm-hmm. right? And it's gone through different waves where, like, assimilation, where Latinos were white, right? And then where they created the term Hispanic. And then now trying to further break it down of, like, Latino, but that's not a race. I mean, personally, I hate the census because of that. Like, I cannot put on there, like, Latino, Latina as a race. You have to choose Black, white, Asian, Native, or something else. I can't remember. And I'm always torn because I feel like I don't have white privilege. I'm also not Afro-Mexicana, right? Like, I know that there are darker brothers and sisters than me. So I struggle with that. I don't ever put white. I always put other, or I'll put Native or Black. Like, it's something else. And that's through my own experiences and connections with my family and my roots. And growing up, like, being one of the darkest children in my family and experiencing what colorism, kind of how it manifests in a community, right? Like, I was called the Prieta, which, you know, is dark, or they would call me Oaxaca, Oaxaquita, which is a reference to, like, a southern part of Mexico where you have more indigenous folks. And so it's supposed to be kind of like, oh, you're dark, like, you know. Yeah. Or my name in Spanish is Abigail. They would switch it to Africail because I was dark. So to kind of, like, put me like, you're the dark child. And so I was confused growing up, like, whoa, why the heck is this such a big deal? Like, all my nicknames have to do with my color. And, like, now I'm much lighter. And I remember my aunts kind of being like, yeah, you know, when you get older, you're going to get lighter. Don't worry. You're not going to stay this dark. And I was like, well, what's the problem, though? What's the issue? And so I think that it's again, I feel like I say everything is complicated.
It is.
But it really, really is how folks internalize it, how it exists in a larger system, and then how it comes down to individual families.
Yeah. Going back to the term Hispanic, it's something that started years ago. I read about it in school. I can't remember the exact details. But it was, in the basic sense, it was just basically anybody that spoke Spanish.
Yeah.
It was, you know, oh, they're Hispanic. You know, and Hispanic doesn't even cover all of Latin America. So Latin America basically is everybody in the North and South America, right? And then you have Hispanic, which includes Spanish-speaking countries like Spain. But it doesn't include countries that were not colonized by Spain. You know, like you talk about Brazil, for example. They're not Hispanic because, you know, they're largely Portuguese-speaking country. So it gets a little complicated. So who's Latino? Who's Hispanic? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. That's why it's hard to identify with those terms. So.
Right. Or you have the country of Guyana, who is predominantly black folk, and the national language is English. But they're the only country that's actually on the continent of, like, Southern America that don't speak Spanish and is majority black folk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Curacao, too.
Yeah.
Suriname. Right.
In the Caribbean.
Bunch of black folks.
All the Caribbean, Trinidad, Tobago, Barbados.
Right. You know. Yeah. All the Caribbean.
Okay, definitely. I'm not, I don't think I'm still clear, though, at what point Latinos started.
We didn't identify ourselves as white. That was the census. That was people in politics doing that. And then, you know, if anybody pushed that term, it was the white Hispanics, you know, like maybe, you know, Cuba, like a lot of the white Cubans that kind of came to here after, you know, Castro took over. You know, a lot of the whiter Hispanic that were allowed into government to make those kind of decisions and define that for us, you know.
And I can't remember, like, an exact date. I feel like I want to give you an exact date of, like, when the term Hispanic was brought in. But I know it correlates with the census. And even in, like, 2003 or something, when Hispanic became the largest majority population, I know that was kind of, like, at its peak. And then being Latino or Latinx is a more recent terms.
Okay. All right, definitely. So let's kind of like talk a little bit more about the relationships in Los Angeles of black and brown people.
I can go right back real
quick. Yeah, go ahead.
I just Googled it really fast. It says, 1970s, the term Hispanic was adopted by the United States government in the early 1970s during the administration of Richard Nixon after the Hispanic members of Interdepartmental Ad Hoc Committee to Develop Racial and Ethnic Definitions recommended a universal term encompassing all Hispanic subgroups.
Okay.
It's basically anybody who spoke Spanish.
So as a person from the Latino community, what is the most appropriate term to use to identify? Do we just like should identify you by the country that you come from and just really ask like, where are you from? As opposed to just assuming and blanket terming Latino? Like what is Latino is the a correct term, right? Just Hispanic is not yeah. Y'all don't like. To be identified.
I personally don't like Hispanic.
Most of us don't like the term Hispanic at all.
I think it depends, honestly, like or at least for me, it depends the place where I'm at and what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think all these terms are complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in the East Coast, everybody called me Spanish. And I was like, don't call me Spanish. but yeah. Personally, I always say either Latina or Mexican American because I can't say Mexican because you're not in Mexico, and that's a whole nother conversation. When you go to Mexico, it's very clear that you're American.
Mm.
Yeah, like that's another problem is that like I'm not in America, I'm considered Mexican, you know, or Latino. But if I go to Mexico, I'm considered American. I'm not considered Mexican because I wasn't born there, and I you know don't speak the language. Without that American accent or like full Mexican accent. That's a problem. So there was something else I was going to say about that term. Oh, even the term Latin America is problematic for some people that are hardcore, you know, anti-colonialists. They're like, you know, we're not Latin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we called Latin?
But we it's have like Chicanos as well. Chicanos,
that's more of a LA thing, you know, like a more north of the border, trying to reclaim your identity. You know, after generations of, you know, being in the side of the border, there's that. But I think the most sensitive issue is that everybody gets assumed to be Mexican and that erases Guatemalans, Salvadorians, you know, Belizeans. It erases a whole spectrum of, you know, Latinos that are out there. So I think the term Latinx has become the more acceptable term.
I think it speaks to the problematic nature of these terms, because it's permanent in Latinx cultures, but then you also see it in Black cultures, right? Like, when I was in the East Coast, a lot of recent immigrants from different countries in Africa did not want to be identified as African American or Black because they had a different experience, or like folks from the Caribbean or Afro Latinos from the Dominican Republic. And so I feel like all these terms are problematic, and a lot of the reason why they're problematic is because we didn't come up with them.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and also, like, it goes back to what you learn when you come here, is that you have to understand that you got to distance yourselves from Black Americans immediately. So that's the reason why some of the most problematic people in the Black community are first and second generation immigrants from throughout the diaspora, which is another difficult conversation. But yeah, they come here and they immediately, what they like to do is to replace Black people who are foundational, because we were enslaved here. You know, we worked, we founded the country, we built the country. A lot of times they want to come here and get closer to power. So when you look at a lot of these people now who are on MSNBC, CNN, the people who are taking a lot of these corporate jobs now, they have quote unquote Black Lives Matter funds. You'll notice that these people are second generation immigrants. Mm-hmm. They're not foundational Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And what they, and if there's a study, I think it was a New York Times article that basically broke down the fact that people who immigrate here from the Caribbean and from Africa are preferred over Black Americans in the corporate world.
Wow.
So there's a whole thing that goes on. And when you see people online on Twitter trying to cause a gender divide and talking about divest and Black men are trash, a lot of times it's people with foreign flags in their bio. It's not a coincidence. So yeah. Black people with foreign flags. But yeah.
Mm, that's an insightful bit of knowledge there.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So actually, that brings me kind of to my next question. Well, topic kind of wanted us to discuss is, when I got back to LA after college, I was really, really concerned and surprised, and I became like a broken record. I would go into businesses and there would be no Black people on the floor, and it maybe stood out to me more because I had just lived in a small rural white environment where diversity and inclusion was all we ever talked about at the university, in the town, you know, making space, equity for Black people, people of color. But in this instance, we're specifically talking about Black people. I would go to various businesses. There would be no Black people on the floor. I would say, can I speak to the manager? I say, what's up with the diversity in here? We would be like in South Central in the community. I say, you know, this is a mixed community. Like, why are there not Black people here too?
What kind of businesses?
That's actually a very important question. It could go down to fast food, little small businesses, Metro PCS stores, which actually I remember the lady from Metro PCS told me that they didn't have no Black people because they needed people to be bilingual for the people that came in to patronize Metro PCS, which I thought was super problematic, because why can't you just have an employee that's bilingual as well as a Black person?
Right.
So I was really surprised that she told me that. So, yeah, it would go down to just, you know, different little shops in the hood. And, you know, the shops that we have, we don't have much, but the fast foods and the corporate little chains, you know, the Panda Expresses and the Starbuckses and the, you know, I will say I do see Black people employed, like, in the grocery stores. And, you know, even if, and then this is just low level. When you start talking about the corporate level, when you start even going into businesses that are, you know, further out from the inner city, first things first that I find super problematic is the further that you drive away from places in Los Angeles, such as like South Central, the Crenshaw District, Leimert Park, where Black people are known to be, the less and less Black people you see in LA County. Like, I don't know if maybe I'm tripping, but that's just like what I've come to understand. And you go to these businesses and there's no Black people employed. And I became like a broken record asking, where's the Black people? Where's the Black people? And they would tell me things like, they don't want to work, you know, they don't want to work. I would say that's racist as hell to even tell me as somebody asking you that, you feel me? Like, you know, and so if you're moving with that idea, if a black person does come up in here and you have already these negative viewpoints, what would make you hire them? I just feel that there's something, these anti-black attitudes in Los Angeles is having very real time effects on the black community. And I just want to ask you guys, are you guys aware of like any, or do you have any idea or perspective to add to what I'm saying in terms of, I feel as a black person, when I go through different places in Los Angeles, I don't see any black people working, and it's all Latin folks on, ooh, I do apologize. It's all
Latinx.
Wait, what the fuck?
Getting caught up in terms?
Yeah, basically, okay, so we for sure not saying Hispanic. Yeah, okay. Or our Latin.
Say brown people.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We see our brown brothers and sisters, you feel me, on the floor at the businesses. And it just, it's simple equation. Like, if we're not employed, then how are we going to sustain ourselves? Do you feel me? Like, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's a couple different factors. I just saw an article, can't remember now, I wish I remembered, but it was talking about the new black exodus of folks leaving LA, like black folks leaving LA and going to like the Inland Empire or going back to the South. And I thought it was really interesting, just like how black people are being pushed again outside of these areas, because I do think it's strategic. I do think there's racial biases and power structures that are pushing folks to leave, because if you can't afford to live here, if you can't find jobs, what are you going to do? You need to survive. So you're going to look for a place where you can survive. So I think that that's one of the reasons. And I think that anti-black sentiments among like brown folks is really high. You know, as with Trump, I feel like things have become more clear of folks that have racist, like, prejudice and ideas. And so people are being more open about having these biases and wanting to be closer to whiteness. And that creates another subdivision with Latinos, because it's like, if you're a certain shade, you're able to then start passing and really get your way into this corporate white world and have more opportunities, versus if you're a more recent immigrant and you're not there. So I think it's a couple of different reasons, but I have seen folks starting like talking about it in articles being written, how there's a new exodus, right? So I do think it's really interesting.
Yeah. Do you have anything, or?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know why. It's an interesting point, and I've followed you for a while, and I remember you always like, where are the black people in these businesses? And I remember you always saying that, and I'd always ask myself too, like, what the deal is. I mean, I don't know. Like, it'd be interesting to like try to do a research and figure out how many black people are even, you know, applying in the first place for these jobs, and how many are actually not getting the jobs, which, you know, I imagine that would be an interesting number to see.
Hey, would you apply in a place where you felt like you wouldn't be welcome even if you got the job?
Well, that's another point. Yeah. Like, do you walk in there and you feel not comfortable? You know, like, is that the situation? I grew up in the trades, you know, my family's all gardeners, you know, landscaping, so plumbers, construction workers, all that stuff. And to me, it was always interesting that, like, I didn't see black people working in those trades, you know, with all these companies. And I always wondered why, you know. And I know that for a fact that we didn't get, you know, black folks applying or asking for work. You know, and I know that was a big problem, you know. But I also know that if they did, you know, one is I'm pretty sure they didn't feel comfortable asking. Two, I'm pretty sure that if they did, they probably wouldn't get the job either.
Well, we used to, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, those trades used to be our trade back in the day. So
that
goes back to what I was saying about white people bringing in groups of people to act as a buffer class without them knowing. Mm-hmm. So as black people started to do civil rights, make some upward mobility and start to get government jobs and stuff like that, we left some of the trades alone that we used to do. And the newer people who came into the country started to fill those positions. So, you know, some people who might not know the history of it might be like, black people don't do this and that. It's like, yeah, it's because we already did that.
Right. Know? Right.
Yeah. And I think that historically, too, that's kind of what started a lot of the racial tension, this like fight for power and accessibility. Right. Like who had these jobs and who was given these jobs. And I think it was around like World War II, in the middle of it and afterwards, when there was all these like industrial jobs, a lot of those jobs were given to Latinos. And then you left all these, like this black community of like, where do we go? And because of, you know, race and like anti-blackness and then these policies that did bring in even more Latinos, where you had, you know, the Bracero program that literally went into Mexico and convinced folks like, come over here and work. And then you create another policy to push them back out. And I think it's created these areas of like, this job is only for Mexicans. This job is only for black people. And this job is only for X, Y, and Z. And it trickles down to an individual level. Like I've heard, I think when I was in New York, this Dominican woman was talking about how her son can't find a job. And she was like darker. Like you would probably think she's like black. You wouldn't think she spoke Spanish or anything. And then my husband was like, oh, you know, he could come work here at some store or whatever. And she was like, oh, no, that job is for Mexicans. Like, no, he's not going to go work there. And so I think that things have now gone down to a personal level. Right. But they're results of these structures that have been very intentional by government policies.
Yeah. Like we've had the Bracero program is something I was thinking about, too. We've had government programs that have helped Latinos, right? Flat out. Like, come to the U.S., get jobs, have roots. But where have been the government programs that have helped black communities, right? They've been, you know, you've been literally disenfranchised in that sense. You know, the communities, you know, you bring these Latinos over, you give them these jobs, you know, which are poor, you know, low-paying jobs. So where can they go live? You put, you know, they get pushed into these communities where black people are already in. Black people are already disenfranchised, right? So now you have Latinos living in areas where black communities are traditional been. You know, like, I grew up in Inglewood, and it turned into, like, you know, from being all white to being all black to, you know, the west side of Inglewood being Latino and the east side being, you know, black. Which creates all these tensions. You know, you have people that are poor, people are, you know, stealing, they're robbing, and, you know, what they see black people. Black people see Latinos, you know, so you start seeing race, you know, because we all fall into this whole racist system in the U.S. But yet Latinos have had more chances than black people, because I think black people are seen badly by, you know, white America. So white people like in Palisades, Malibu, Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, you know, who are they going to want to go clean their house? A more whiter, light-skinned Latino or like a darker-skinned black person? And that's a fact. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a fact. And it's ingrained racism. Mm-hmm, it's distrust. Sure, these white people will say like, oh, we're not racist. You know, I got black friends, shit like that. You know, I work with a black person at my office, you know. Mm-hmm. But like, will they welcome a black person to come clean their home? You know, and this is, you know, that's part of the deep-rooted, like, tensions that happen, you know? Like, Latinos can go out on the streets and sell, you know? And I think people will go and buy from the Latinos. But if you have black people start selling on the streets, and I've seen it, I don't think they get as much traffic from people. Mm. You know, they struggle more, you know? And I think it's just part of this whole, these optics that have been put on everybody.
So. That boils down to skin color.
Right.
You know, because we're in America and they got white supremacy cracking and controlling everything. So lighter complexion, you can blend in with them, pass with them. And it really strains the communities, you know, that are struggling to even survive. So I feel like we've unpacked a lot, you know, and I really appreciate the perspective of you guys. Like, you know, I wanted it to be balanced. You feel me? And I'm glad that I was able to talk with you guys. So what do you think are some, like, ways that we, like, what do you think needs to happen? You know, I know some people, you know, and this doesn't reflect, you know, the people in this room, but, you know, when I posted that I was going to do this podcast, and I wake up and it has like almost 200 comments, and people are like arguing and going back and forth. And, you know, some people are very supportive. A lot of people are very supportive, saying what they want to hear, you know. There's a lot of different ideas and perspectives. Ideally for you, what would you like to see come from what's happening? Do you feel that there needs to be solidarity and unity? Or do you feel that, like, these issues are so ingrained into our communities that maybe, like, we need to, like, focus on working within our communities and then coming back at a later date to kind of build solidarity?
Mm-hmm. The way I see it, I think that the more, first of all, I think we need more investment in the communities. You know, I think we need to create more jobs, more opportunities. You know, I think we need to have banks, you know, make loans more accessible for people to start their own businesses. I think the city needs to invest more money on the streets, making streets look nicer, you know, like the way they do all over the city, and create opportunities for people to actually grow. And I think once you create those opportunities for people to grow, whether it be educationally, entrepreneurially, you start to offer these opportunities where people can start interacting and collaborating more. You know what I mean? And I think once you start having people have those opportunities to work together, to live together in a nice neighborhood, you know, and nice parks, and start creating more recreational activities around that, and people start to gather together more, I think that starts building more bonds. And the only thing we can do is try to build up our neighborhoods and our, you know, relationship with each other. You know, because I think for as long, you know, I think COVID has also exacerbated these tensions, because now you have more people without jobs. You know, more people are on the streets. A lot of kids. That's why these kids are doing these stupid, like, challenges and beating up on street vendors. You know, it's some stupid Instagram challenge that they're doing, and people don't talk about that, but that's what it is. You know, and they're bored. They're out there, you know, like, you know, so let's invest in the community. Let's put programs, after school programs or day programs, for these kids to be able to educate themselves, distract themselves, play sports, work together, be on the same team, you know, like, you know, with brown kids, black kids. But until that happens, it's always going to be, it's going to be a mess, especially with COVID. You know, poverty creates problems, you know, and those problems are hard to get past and build on if we don't, you know, invest. That's my own take.
Definitely. Anyone else have anything to share?
Yeah, I think that loyalty comes before unity. So if black people kind of have a bad habit of saying black and brown a lot when it doesn't necessarily help us. Because when we look at the relationship thus far, you know, if I had to just poll the room and just say, what have black people gotten out of the quote unquote black and brown relationship? I can't really point to a lot of wins. So to me, I think at this point for black people, it's more important for us to focus on ourselves than try to unify with other groups, because that's just a way of escaping having to do the work. And if we can figure out our own business first, then we're going to be in a position to be able to partner with other communities who are willing to show equal loyalty, not 25%, not 75%. If you want us to ride with you against your enemies, you got to ride with us against ours. And if we're not getting that in return, then there's no point. We might as well just focus on what we're doing, you know, individually. And that's fine. It doesn't mean we have to hate each other. It just means that we have a very specific history in this country. We have a very specific agenda that we need to get accomplished, and some things that are going on that are specific to our group that the country caused. And as long as we're out here fighting for this group, and we can't even get a Black Lives Matter thing off the ground without it turning into, let's talk about trans lives. And it's like, we didn't bring that to the table. Like, the white supremacist system, the LGBTQ system, which is run by white people, pushed that agenda on us to divert our energy. So they only do that to us because every time we get our energy up and rolling, something good happens. So the ultimate thing for me is black people need to just focus on themselves right now. I think that's the most intelligent thing that black people can do. Stop running around trying to fight everybody's battles and fight your own, because how can you possibly... It's like inviting somebody to your house to come eat when you haven't made sure that your kids can eat first. that makes no sense. So you got to focus on taking care of your household, your community, building it back up. And then you will have the respect that you need of other communities. You'll get them to act right. But first, you have to take care of what you got to take care of at home. So that's my perspective on it.
Yeah, I feel that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there has to be a level of uncomfortability to get anywhere. But I'm a little hesitant to say, like, you do you first and then we'll do this, because we've seen it happen, right? Like, even with voting, like, Black men were able to vote before Black women. So it's just like you lose like, the LGBTQ community is also present in the Black community, right? And so there's all these intersections of, like, all right, what is the right way to go about it? Like, do we make a list of, like, we focus on Black people and then we focus on Black trans lives and then we focus on, like, Black women, or
we just, you know, focus on Black people? That's the thing. The whole intersectionality thing is a trick, because it's meant to divert energy. Nobody ever said Black women's lives didn't matter. Nobody said Black trans lives didn't matter. When we said Black Lives Matter, we knew who we were talking about. We're out here still talking about Breonna Taylor every day. We're saying her name.
Mean. Okay.
You know, when there were some girls who were up in Milwaukee who went missing. Black men went in the street armed and went to the house, burnt the house down that they were in, got the girls out. Yeah. Right. And Black men, you know, we're always like the subject of, like, oh, you're trying to silence this community or that community within the Black community. It's crazy. It makes no sense. So when we say Black Lives Matter, that's it. Black disabled, Black Muslim, Black Christian, Black trans, Black is Black. But when you start to divert the energy, then you can start to create wedges between people. That's the whole point, is to get this community within Black community to talk about this other subgroup. Well, you're not doing enough for us, and you're not. Nah. Black first, Black last. That's it.
Yeah.
No, I see what you mean. Yeah, you're right. Because then it's like we have to worry about being, like, politically correct about terms. Mm. And where do you go from there? And it does. It takes away from the energy. But I back, like, what I'm was trying to say is, like, there has to be this level of uncomfortableness. And I do think that, for at least personally, for me being Latina, in order to start anywhere, I feel like we do have to start with the Black community, because the experience that Black people have here is not the same as Latinos. And I feel like it's I feel like we have to start there. For me, when we talk about Black lives and getting justice there, it's going to eventually impact the Latino community. I don't feel like there's a need to be like, no, we got to focus on brown lives as well. And, you know, I think that it's going to happen. If you focus on Black lives, you're also advocating for your community.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. How do you envision both communities working towards fighting police brutality? Do you feel that, like, we should individually do that, or do you feel like that should be a unified front, or do you feel that it should be, like, separate because both communities are experiencing it differently? Like, you know, like, just when we boil down to specific issues, like, you know what I'm saying, that both communities might be experiencing. How do we go about things like that?
I don't know. You know, the brown community has outnumbered the white community on the LAPD and the sheriff's department for quite some time now. Mm-hmm. So I think we got to start asking that question of, okay, you know, and this goes back to, like, how do you fix relations within communities? People who are within the community have to start to call out the other people within their own communities who aren't about progress and who have decided to sell out to the system. So we got a lot of people who are in the police force who now outnumber white people, but it seems as if they might have taken on that mentality that white police officers have instilled in them. So I don't know how we stop police brutality. Like, how do we fight it when a lot of the members are coming from the community that, you know, I think it's a dicey issue, man. I really don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, the fact that, like, it's like 53% of the sheriff and LAPD are Latino. It's a crazy fact. And then to think about, like, the sheriffs had operations like in Santa Clarita a couple years ago where they literally were targeting Latino drivers, pulled over like, I don't know, like 600 or 700 Latino drivers in a span of a time, and only like 2% accounted, they found anything like drugs or anything bad. So it's going back to this issue within the Latino community, how we're racist against ourselves. We are. Nobody hates Latinos, Mexicans more than Latinos and Mexicans do.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's like that struggle of like trying to assimilate?
I think it's a power struggle. It's like going back to like your proximity to whiteness. Mm-hmm. Like depending what your migration story was, depending what your skin tone is, like it's that theory. I don't know if y'all heard of it, like the crab theory, like the crab's trying to get out of the bucket.
Yeah, crab's right, the girl, yeah.
Right. We keep like pulling each other down instead of helping, you know, somebody to get out, and then it just ends up being that we're all stuck down here. And I think that that's what happens. Like, people see, like, where's my end? Am I closer to power and whiteness? I'm going to take it. Even if that means, you know, because I might have more in common with, I don't know, like a Black Caribbean than I do with like a Mexican person. Like, it's so many intersections that happen, and I keep talking about how they go down to a personal level, because that's where we see it manifested in our communities, right? It's these bigger structures that happen, and then they go down to like internalized, and then you internalize it and you act on things.
I definitely feel like it's an assimilation thing, mm-hmm. an acceptance thing.
Yeah.
I have a cousin of mine who I grew up with, you know, and he joined the Navy. You know, he was a knucklehead growing up, and we always got into trouble. Wanted to, you know, do a career for himself. He joined the Navy. He became in the Navy. Came out of the Navy. Then he went into the Border Patrol. And I've stopped talking to him because I've seen his comments now, like through social media. And I'm just like, dude,
how? He probably sounds like them now.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds just like them. And yeah. I know plenty of people like that. Like so many Latinos are in the Border Patrol.
It's not just them though. We got Black officers sometimes that show out more in front of white cops. I got pulled over in Culver City one time by a Black officer, and I could have swore he was white. Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't know, man. It's like, again, like when they, anybody goes into the force, it's like they turn into somebody different.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it's something you need to accept, is that when they go into those systems, they're not like Latino, they're not Black anymore.
Yeah, you might have lost them because if they, it's a means of survival, they have to adapt and take in those principles that that law enforcement has. You know, like at the end of the day, you guys outnumber whites, but whites still run everything mm-hmm. within law enforcement. So when you get to that point, you have to either accept, or you're going to make yourself a target probably within that system.
Right.
You know? So
you get brainwashed into thinking that, oh, everybody coming over the border is bringing drugs. They're sex traffickers. Everybody. You know, everybody in the communities are, you know, it's a battleground. We got to go out there and defend ourselves all the time. That's why you have Latinos clearly 18-year-old kids in Compton, like Andres Guardado. That's why you got a bunch of mobs in East L.A. The Sheriff's Department in East L.A. is predominantly Latino. And they got the gang, the banditos. They have deputy gangs.
Is that why it's an unspoken rule that you don't travel to East L.A. as a Black person? I'm just kidding.
I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I know that the Mexican mafia has always been a hard line with racial, you know, tensions. They don't want Black gangs or Black people going into the communities because they feel that they're a threat. And so any actions, like in East L.A., that was a Mexican mafia action.
And they pushed the line in prison.
Yeah.
I've been told. I've never been there. But I've been told that prison, I was really surprised to be told this by a very trusted source. So I know it wasn't Cap because they had to live there. That in prison, it's racial politics runs like the prison, right. And it's divided, you know, down to like where you go on the yard and who you eat with the chow, and that the Latino males in prison are broken up by the Southern and the Northern.
Yeah, Sureños, Norteños.
Mm-hmm. Right, and mm-hmm. that the Norteños, which would be like the Latino males from like Oakland area, they run with the Black people in prison, but the Southern Latin males, they run in with the Aryan Brotherhood, because there's been some kind of like link there that was been made in prison or something like that. And I was blown away, and I was like, well, what happens when some of these males, Latino males, the Sureños, are released back on the streets to places like Los Angeles with, you know, like, do they still move with these attitudes, or do they just leave that in prison? You know, so I always wondered that. Like, what implications does that have in the community?
I've known some old veteranos that have gone out and come back to, like, Venice or Cooper City and immediately got into trouble, shot somebody, killed somebody, you know, just because they're stuck in that old, you know, that system and that mentality. Mm-hmm. And then immediately go back to prison. Mm-hmm. You know, so that does happen. But I'm not an expert on, like, the whole prison thing.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely people internalize. Like, I feel like when I was growing up, a lot of my uncles are racist, maybe are still racist. And I grew up hearing that. And my family was one of the few that was in Compton. And everybody talked about us. Like, why are you guys in Compton? And, oh, you guys go to school in Compton. And my uncles are still very much like that. And so my husband is Black. My kids are biracial. And I was like, okay, how is this going to look like bringing in my husband with extended family? Like, how do you have those conversations? Because they have it embedded because of, like, gang violence. And it's been interesting on a personal level seeing how that manifests itself. Like, my uncle spending time with my husband and be like, oh, like, you're different. And me telling him, like, what does that mean? Like, that doesn't help either. Just because you met, like, okay, you're saying this one Black guy is different. Is that going to change how you're going to act to other Black men? You know, so I think it's problematic and it's hard. And in any little interruptions and uncomfortability that I can play a part of, I feel like it's important, and we hope that it has a larger impact, you know, because I've seen it on both sides. I feel like I've grown up on seeing this tension in both. Like, I got backlash from Latinos, like, Latino men for, you know, being with my husband, or just, like, whatever. I've gotten backlash from Black women for being with a Black man. And so it's just, like, and I'm thinking, like, how is that going to trickle down to my kids who are biracial? Depending on, like, their light, like, their skin tone, people are going to treat them as, like, Mexican girls or Black girls. What is that going to look like? And how is that going to, I think, impact, like, colorism as we continue to evolve as a society, and there's more, even more, like, biracial relationships and kids coming into play? Like, I mean, I think that'll be interesting to see, I don't know, years from now, what that conversation is going to look like. Because kids are going to struggle with, how do I identify? Am I this? Am I that? Where do I belong?
Definitely. How old are your... Oh, you just had your baby. So you haven't had these conversations.
Yeah, yet. My oldest is two. And then I just had my little girl. She's 2 months. So,
okay. So there's
a little.
Yeah, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about immigration. So, you know, many people in the Black community who don't come from the immigrant perspective, you know, there are Black immigrants who actually kind of get erased or lost when we talk about immigration. And the Latino community has kind of been made like the poster child for immigration issues, I feel like, from my perspective. Mm-hmm. But there are Black people that are immigrants. But for African American people in South Central and Compton who don't come from that immigrant perspective might not really understand just kind of what causes, you know, people to migrate from their country. You know, and what even kind of just like what America is doing to their country in the first place that's causing them to come here as well. And so let's just talk a little bit about, like, what are some of the reasons why people are migrating from places such as Mexico that does share a border with the United States? And just some of the reasons why that happens in such rates.
I guess I'll go. Well, I feel like it's changed over the years. You know, there's been different reasons why. You know, going back to, you know, before the border was taking anything seriously and you could just go over with a license. And people just came for work. You had the Bracero program. You know, people were brought and then invited over and then kicked back out. And for the most part, people from, like, Mexico and Central America came to the U.S. to work. They wanted to work, get some money, send it back home, and then move back home. You know, but a lot of people through politics, you know, like, oh, they're coming to take over, you know, but that was the furthest thing from the fact. And, you know, during that time period, as people were doing that, you had, you know, you government interventions, you know, in Central America, you know, you had, you know, in Colombia, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, and it's still going on. And, you know, all these government interventions have, like Honduras, have basically replaced legitimate governments, have gone into, you know, take all their materials, their wealth, you know, their resources. You know, you have like the Banana Republic issue, you know, taking over the bananas, taking over the coffee. You know, we're talking about specific industries, corporate-led industries, using government funds and government agencies to go into Central America to destabilize the government so they can take all the resources, which has created chaos, created revolutionary armies in El Salvador, where revolutionary armies are fighting politics and people, our civilians, are getting stuck in the middle. You have now, you have, like, gangs taking over Guatemala, you know, and people are running. You know, there's no other options because they're so poor. There's no economy. There's no jobs. And the only option is to get involved with the gang. And if you don't get involved with the gang, well, then you're screwed. Your whole family gets targeted. So now the immigration that's happening in the U.S. is now more flight than opportunity. You know, so that's changed. That's the change now, is that it's not so much coming here to look for jobs. It's trying to get away from all that. All of that the U.S. has caused in all these countries, so people have, you know, they're literally running for their lives. I mean, why would somebody put their babies and their children on their back? You know, they have their fathers have been killed, you know, their brothers have been killed, they're caught up in the violence. Trek through, first of all, the Mexican border, which is probably worse than the American border.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's way crazier down on the Mexican border, on the south, with Central America. That border is, I mean, people get disappeared all the time. People get killed. I mean, forget about family separation over here. That what goes down there, and that's U.S. money pushing that, you know? And that's like the current Mexico, President of Mexico, Morena, who's taking this money, and we're like, oh, yeah, we'll take care of this, but be cool with us up here, even though, you know, Trump's not being cool over here anyways. So there's a lot of government intervention on these borders and in these governments, and these people are just caught in the middle of it. They got nothing. They're leaving their homes. They're coming over here seeing flight. You know, they get to the borders. They're seeking asylum, which the U.S. should be accepting them on those terms because it's, you know, one of the U.N. rules. But they're not. They're getting separated, and they're just going through the most horrific of time. You know, so that's the problem. And there's actually a drop in Mexican immigration into the U.S. now because, you know, you have this problem where, like, a lot of the farms in Central America or in, you know, the Bible Belt, they don't have enough immigrant workers to do those jobs. You know, there's that problem. I know through my family still working the trades, they can't find enough people to do those jobs, you know. So that is a problem. That's kind of been the change now. So that's where we're at with immigration. Do you have anything to add, Abu?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all policy driven. I think that before people were coming just to work and go back, you have that generation of folks that just really wanted to come here, get enough money, send it back to their parents, and, you know, go back. I know, like, my dad is still part of that generation. He's out there in Mexico right now, like, I'm fixing up my house to go back.
That's what's up.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, the idea, I think, with that generation is that they're realizing, I came here to get work and go back, but now I'm just working until I die. You know, like, you're not going to live, you know, you have to work until you retire. And by the time you retire, you're, like, close to your deathbed pretty much. And so they're having that kind of realization of, you know, I'm just going to go back, and you can survive with a lot less and live comfortably in other countries if you're lucky to have been here. But a lot of people, I think, yeah, are coming now because like seeking refuge, and the U.S. is directly involved. And we've seen that since, like, NAFTA started, and the U.S. has been in every single civil war in Latin American countries. Like, they've been involved. I think the U.S. is the only one that's had troops in other countries. I don't think any other country does that, to have, like, a place where they have troops. And so the U.S. is, I think, very strategic in what they're doing and what they're creating. It's a whole cycle And people are really just trying to survive. And as crazy as we are here and as much violence as we are here, there's still a little bit more opportunity than in these other countries. So I agree. I think it's a survival move.
Danny, do you have anything you'd like to add, or would you like to, you know, like discuss something specifically? Make sure that, you know, I'm like touching on topics that, or concerns that we all have, you know? So do you have anything that's coming up during the conversation as I refine my focus?
You are more a most gracious host. Thank you. So, yeah, we good. I think the one thing that we didn't talk about, though, when we talked about jobs and why Black people probably aren't being hired, is because of are just now coming into the understanding of group economics and how to participate in that the right way. Because that all of this kind of goes back to before we had a large influx of Latino immigrants. When the Italians came, they took over all the trades, you know, so they had the trades, they had the docks, they had the fire department. So there were specific places that they cornered to make sure that once they cornered those things, the other people who came behind them from their mother countries were able to find opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my uncle's coming here. I'm Italian. He's getting here. I can make him a firefighter. I can make him a dock worker. Now he has money. Next thing you know, if he's savvy enough, he might become a union leader. He might become a politician. Like, this is the through line and how to get from A to Z. So for us, you know, and I think that other communities, when they come here, they have the advantage of in their own home countries having been in business and having worked with each other, and there's a certain trust level there. So when you get into an area like, you know, just like a T-Mobile store, and you can corner that, and yeah, you start hiring more and more people who look like you. I think the challenge for us as Black people is that we never really applied that policy to everybody else. When if you were cool, that's just how we are as a people. It might be part of the reason why we got enslaved in the first place. Like, we're just, if you're cool, we're willing to listen. And if you're cool, I'm not gonna be like, yo, you Mexican, you can't work here. You know what I'm saying? It's like, no, that's the homie. Like, I'm gonna hire my other homeboy I grew up with. Like, we all just here, you know. But then I think the challenge that we've had and we've seen is that, like, after we've kind of extended that olive branch and that bridge, then all of a sudden it kind of changes to where, like, the people who come in end up being like, nah, we don't, like, we just hiring our own folks, you know? And then Black people are like, yo, what are we doing? Like, I thought it was all good. So, like, one of my homies works, you know, in sanitation. So he drives trash trucks, and he was just like, yo, my yard is the last yard. You know, we used to be everywhere. He said, now it's all Latinos, man. They not hiring Black folks. And I think that, you know, and so his yard is like, they're trying to just get as many brothers in as they can, not as a way to be discriminatory against any other group, but just as a means of survival. Because it's like, man, the walls are closing in. They trying to push us out. We got to try to hold down this last little corner that we have, you know. So I think that that's really what's fueling a lot of the clashes in and around Los Angeles, is that we like, yo, man, when we go into these places, we don't see any of us, and we don't do that same thing. And you know, now we're starting to practice group economics. Slowly, we're starting to adopt the principles that people have been trying to beat into our heads for years, especially our generation. Thank God, is starting to reject a lot of that, you know, civil rights era stuff of just trying to get along and the whole thing. But that is definitely the major factor that's pushing everybody right now. It's just like, man, yeah, we can't keep getting into these situations where, you know, we're the one Black person on the job, you know, or no Black people. Because to segue off of that just for a second, one thing I got to be honest with y'all about is that whenever the numbers have been cool, like in balance, where there's like 5 Black people and 4 Latinos, or 5 Black people and 5 Latinos, everything's cool. But then the moment that we start to lose our numbers and you guys are gaining, the work environment turns hostile towards us. You know, one of my homies is, he's a bank manager, and, he was at a branch that's in a black community, and slowly as I would go in, I'm like, yo, we're all the black people. He like, bruh. And what ended up happening was they were trying, people who worked there were trying to set him up to get fired. So they asked him, like, yo, what were you doing this weekend? What's up, man? What you get into? Oh, man, you know, I did such and such. And then, like, they would go back and tell the district manager, like, oh, yeah, you know, he said he was out doing yada, yada. And then they tried to report him one time, like, you know, he came in smelling like weed. And I'm like, bro, we in the hood. Everybody smells like weed when they come into the bank. You know what I'm saying? But they were doing it to try to get him out. And I think that's the place where it's like those of us who are not hostile towards each other, like all of us in this room, we don't have no issues with each other. We just all trying to live and do well. You know, I think that's where black people, we depend on you guys in the Latino community to be like, hey, enough is enough with that. You know, we can't keep doing that because A, they're not doing it to us. And B, it's just going to turn this thing into a full blown war that's not going to stop. You know, so that's just my perspective on the job thing.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect example, too, where the Latino community could be like, okay, in order to help my own community, I have to start with helping the black community. Like, what can I do? I think that starting there is important.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even asking y'all to put down your struggle to come pick up ours, you know, because you got your own issues that you got to battle. So I get that coming from a community full of issues. All I'm saying is that I think that we could really benefit from you guys pushing back against those things that are happening that you're seeing. Because, you know, it's just like with white folks, they always want to talk about how they're not racist, but they sit and observe racist things all the time and don't say anything. And just like silence is compliance, you know? Right.
And so do so many Latinos. They'll see it and then just say nothing about it or do nothing about it, and it's the same thing. Like, I see it a lot with Latino Christians that will be very, God, like, conservative and be like, yeah, you know, I'm all about, you know, God, and we're all, you know, God's children, whatever, whatever. And then you're voting these policies that are going to further affect, you know, our black community. So it's like,
yeah, would Jesus vote for Trump right now? Like,
right, and that pisses me off. Like, I have heated conversations with some of my family members. Like, so you're Christian, but you're doing this? Like, no, you can't. Like, what space are you operating out of?
Christian Latinos are the biggest hypocrites I've ever met in my life.
Christians are the biggest hypocrites.
I mean, I personally, too. Like, I have, so my family is majority Christian, and I had issues with the Latino community because I wasn't Catholic. They would be like, oh, so, like, you know, you're going to go to hell because you don't believe, you don't pray to Guadalupe. And I was like, what? As a kid, like, they would try to convert me. Like, let me put a cross on you, like the Ash Wednesday or something. So I would get a lot of heat from Latinos. And then I grew up kind of going to, like, predominantly black churches. And that was also interesting because it was like, well, what are you doing here? But that's been my experience. And I feel that was like a Christian church, and I've always internalized that of like, okay, I gotta help everybody. I can't be like, well, only Latinos because we're Christian. And like, what do you think? It's all gonna be segregated afterwards. I feel like it's so hypocritical.
Yeah. Latinos have a lot of issues. We the community has a lot of issues to contend with amongst themselves. I mean, there definitely isn't a unity at all. Like, I mean, we can't get ourselves together to form our own movement, you know, for the life of us. You know, and what pisses me off is seeing, like, you know, on the Instagram pages, especially a lot of these meme pages, you know, like, Black Lives Matter movement has been working for years to build this movement, right? And to build the term Black Lives Matter. And you get all these racist Latinos always, like, you know, and some of these meme pages are like, you know, oh, well, what about brown lives?
Yeah.
Well, what about Brown Lives Matter? I'm like, first of all, don't appropriate a term that somebody else already worked hard to build. Second of all, if you're really concerned about Brown Lives Matter, why now are you just saying that in response to Black Lives? Why weren't you saying something like that before? Why weren't you concerned before? You know, like, why does it have to be a reaction to some movement that's honest, that's been, you know, been invested in, that's been worked on, and it's been a problem for years? And why can't we just support that? Why does it have to be like, well, brown people, you know, they get killed by police too? Yeah. You know, like, well, yeah, then the fucking help out Black Lives Matter. You know,
everybody's, like, because people think that we're saying it to compete, I think, to get attention from white people. And it's like, I think what they don't understand is that the younger generation of black people don't care at all about what white people think. Like, our parents did and our grandparents, that's, they lived their life based off of what white people thought. Right. You know, my grandmother picked cotton. The same hands that raised me, the same ones I can touch now. She, you know, being in Arkansas, she wasn't a slave, but that just shows you how close, right? And my great-grandfather was a farmer. Like, you know, he had to bow his head kind of and shuffle by to make sure he didn't end up in a tree somewhere. My father had to go be driven around a different route home because they had lynched somebody in Indiana where he was from. So that's the, you know, people think that we're like fighting to get attention. Like, man, we fighting to get free. Right. You know what I'm saying? We fighting to get out from under worrying about what they think and liberating our minds. And people are like, well, brown lives too. And I'm just like, bro, you right. You definitely right, because stuff happens to y'all too. I think that the best strategy, though, is to throw your weight behind us. Not because I feel like we necessarily need more. I just think that black people have a history of kind of busting the door open and leaving it cracked for everybody else to come through. And that kind of goes back to civil rights. Like, we busted the door open and we left it cracked for a lot of groups of people, including white women, who somehow snuck into the white minority conversation.
Right.
You know, the same Karens that's out here doing this crazy stuff, they're considered a minority. So we when we get in, we're not selfish about it. You know, we just like, man, look, we in, we straight. And you know what I'm saying? The Mexican homie got to come through. I got to leave the door cracked for him. And that's, you know, I feel like that's the strategy that can work, because, you know, I think that that'll be helpful. And yeah, man, it's just one of those things where, like, Black Lives Matter is a movement that we worked a long time to get recognized, you know, and it's not a competition thing. We're not trying to get, you know, closer to the master on that one, you know.
And I think the common denominator is like white supremacy, right?
Always.
And if you dismantle white supremacy and blackness, everything else is going to fall.
Right. If we get free, it definitely will be a domino effect for everybody.
Yep.
But I think I think that black people are issues never really get addressed at the root, because we include everybody. And then, I don't want to use the term water it down, but we just never get to where we need to address at the root issue. This is actually something that I want to touch on real quick. I want to switch gears a little bit, because I definitely want to get this in here before we close out. As somebody, you work in music, and we've been talking a lot about the lack of black people in certain spaces. And something that's really bothering me is like the lack of black women that are like on LA's hip hop radio. And there's like an oversaturation of like my Latina sisters. And I just want to know like why. But when I do listen to it, and when I look at the website, it's just not adding up. You feel me?
Yeah.
And we have multiple shows that are either like white DJs or all Latino like segments.
Yeah.
Like the Cruise Show. I hate to say that, but like if we can have an all Latino and Latina show on LA hip hop radio, why don't we have the same for black people? Why it seems to be like if we have a black co-host, it has to be accompanied by a Latina or not a black woman.
Yeah.
So the erasure of black women on LA hip hop radio is like an extreme problem for me. I don't know if you guys noticed that, but do you have anything like to add to that? Or do you know why that is? Or like,
yeah, I know exactly why it is. And again, like, this is, if we take every issue that we talked about today and we put it back in context, you got to crawl before you walk, right? Any human crawls before they walk. So the same concept applies here. You start with white supremacy and you move up from there. If you take everything and put it in that context, you'll understand. So the Democratic Party, for example, now is focused on mobilizing, in Hillary Clinton's words, the Latino vote. The reason why is not because they love y'all. They feel like now they can't depend on black people. You have the numbers and you're like, your community might be a little bit more receptive to what they have to say because you haven't been here dealing with them in such close proximity as we have, right, for hundreds of years. So they're pulling you in now, right? Numbers. LA radio is the same way. There was a point in time when Power 106 was like, yo, we the home of hip hop. And there were no black people on the radio. Zero. The only one was Big Boy in the Morning. They had no mixers, no hosts beyond that. So, and that goes back down to obviously erasing people, but it's a demographic thing. They say at the top, the people who own the stations, who run the stations, it's always white folks, right? And white supremacy.
I think a Cuban owned. So it's, there's a Cuban owned station. I don't know if it's 92 or Power 106, but like they're like minority owned, but like from Cuba.
White identified mm-hmm, Cuban, mm-hmm. right?
White yeah. passing, I mean, maybe.
Cubans okay. usually like own most of the Latino television, whatchamacallit. The yeah. stations. It's mostly white Cuban owned.
Oh, wow.
Because they were the first, like, Latino immigrants that came to the U.S. that was accepted because they were white and wealthy.
Those are all the ones that Castro kicked out.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So they were the first ones. And then when Cuba started sending black people, then the U.S. was like, oh, no.
No. Oh. Stop it there.
So, okay. So I mean, essentially a white person is what right. we're talking about, right? So, yeah.
basically.
So what they'll do is they'll look at the demographics of L.A. and they'll say, well, this market is predominantly Latino, so we need to put people on the radio who reflect that, right? And I agree. If you are in a market that is predominantly one way, it would make sense to have people on in media who reflect those people who are listening. But you can't do it at the expense of knocking out the people who are the reason why you have the station in the first place. You can't have rap without black people. So for them to do that, you know, it plays into a bigger movement within entertainment space and hip hop in general to kick black people out. So when you look at record labels, I can go down a list and tell you about how many record labels, black music departments are run by white people mm-hmm. and others. The reason why they do that is because they're trying to figure out a way to put us in the corner of the room while everybody else can access the benefits of hip hop. So that's what you're seeing being reflected on the radio. We're going to put black people in the very corner of the room, maybe give them a couple token positions here and there, but we're going to figure out how to monetize their culture at a higher level and a more efficient level than they can. So that's what's going on.
So how can we fight back as like black people? We don't have the demographics in LA to like cause an uproar and get more black people hired, or do we just accept it because like that's the demographics? Or like, and I don't want to deny like our Puerto Rican brothers and sisters space, because anybody that knows hip hop knows that like these were the kids that were performing these moving elements before hip hop was established as this thing that we're the corporations now are marketing, right? So I'm not trying to deny my Puerto Rican brothers and sisters space, but these aren't really, I don't know what the percentage is of these like DJs or people even being Puerto Rican in LA. Like I don't.
Yeah.
I think that's one area where, like, you know, we need more, you know, like a community investment. Like for example, LA Taco. I love LA Taco because it's one of the few publications, if not the only publication, that doesn't really care about, you know, appealing to a larger demographic, you know, which is very capitalistic. And, you know, we don't care about, like, putting an article out, like, recently in the Zapotec language, which nobody's going to read, mm-hmm. except for, like, a very small community. But that to us is important because it's a voice, and it needs to be out there. And I think that we need to do something like that in a radio station where it's, you know, started up again, because fuck all these other radio stations, man. They're already, like, controlled mm-hmm. through a system. I stopped listening to the radio, like, a long time ago.
Yeah. But you know? Think it's a larger, like, it goes back. I know we didn't talk too much about like media and culture, but how black culture is exploited and then not in those spaces. Like it's not just in radio, but it's like the artists and then how other folks, non-black folks, kind of buy into it and then are able to benefit some of those things. I think it's a bigger problem and an example of just how a society we are exploiting black people and black culture and not allowing folks to actually be invested like financially, like really right. be rewarded for that, you know, like you, if you're a black artist, most likely your whole group is going to be like white. You're going to have white engineers, white, you know, people in the record label and all these things. And it's just it should be predominantly black because you're selling this, you're right. saying that you're selling like black culture, and then there's no black people and yeah. then specifically black women
yeah. yeah. But like what I was saying in the 90s, was it like this one company went and bought like all the radio stations and then just inputted a formula. And it's been the same formula forever now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why when you go, you can go to several different states and the radio sound, like back in the day, it would sound different.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the DJs back in the day on Mix Show were responsible for breaking local artists. So they would come there, bring their record, and they'd be like, yo, I'm playing it because I like it. And it becomes a regional hit, and then they become a national star. That was the pathway before. But now you go to Texas, you can go to this market, that market, and you hearing the same 10 records. Right, and that's a much deeper tinfoil hat type conversation I'm going to have about trying to dumb down everybody's frequencies, so that way we're not independent and thinking for ourselves and hearing different textures and cultures and stuff like that. But ultimately, when you say like, what do we have to do? We have to get out of the system, and that's the hard part. Is like trying to convince people to get off the quote unquote plantation, right? Like if we're gonna talk about them not what they're not doing for us, our next conversation has to be like, what are we going to do for ourselves? Because if not, we're at their table groveling right now. You know, like they're creating these slush funds or whatever that are supposed to be going towards Black Lives Matter. But when you see the people who are going to oversee the disbursement of the funds, they're just like the people who were you're just taking a black token person and putting them in a position. They're not even connected to the community. How are they going to know where to send the money? You know, so it's one of those things where we have to, as a people, all of us, if we're all in here like, yo, we're recognizing that the system is not it, right? You're talking about the article that you're writing with L.A. Taco and how it's going to appeal to those people, and you feel fulfilled because you're touching the group of people you want to touch. Then that's what we got to do. We got to go back to going direct to the community and bypassing the corporate structure. And the challenge in that is like trying to figure out, how do I pay my bills in the process of doing that, right?
Right, because all of these institutions weren't made for us, were not made for black and brown people. And so it's like this constant struggle of, how do I dismantle this structure, this institution, but like within it, you know, I haven't figured it out, but I feel like I've heard a lot of folks struggle with this, right? Like education was not made for us, you know, all these things were not made for us. And it's just, so they're inherently not going to work. And where do you go from there? Like, you have to completely tear it down and start something new. But then you have folks that are like, no, I'm just going to infiltrate it and then, you know, move my way up. And, you know, I'm gonna change it that way, like within it.
Like nobody's ever done it.
But it's just not going to work. Yeah, it's not going to work.
Yeah, nobody's ever done it.
Right,
yeah.
That approach isn't working.
Okay. Any last thoughts before we close out? I just want to say that I really, really appreciate you guys. You all, sorry, let me get my pronouns together. You all and your time and your insight. And like, this is a podcast episode that I have been supposed to do, but I had to wait a little bit because Abigail, you just had a baby. But I'm so happy that I waited because I think this was the perfect group of people. There's so much to expound on and just to talk about. I think that the black and brown relations in Los Angeles is a continuing conversation that different groups of people should pick up and also have these conversations as well. You feel me? So I encourage other people, if this is something that you're passionate about, all the people that leave comments online, you know, let your voice be heard. You know, we can all share our thoughts, but I just hope that it's always coming from a place of openness and respectfulness. So yeah, before we close out, anyone have any last thoughts to share?
I just want to say to all my like brown folk community, like, it's stop, you know, stop being so divisive, stop being so hateful. Let's break out of that. You know, that's what the government wants. That's what the powers that be want. Let's be smarter and let's be better. And let's work towards leaving all that behind and, you know, joining with our, you know, our black brothers and anybody, our whole community. You know, that we need to start building together because, well, it's important. We need that.
Yeah, and I would just add to that to encourage folks to check their own biases. And to really start that inner work, as uncomfortable as it is, like, everybody has biases.
Yes.
And you're not going to make any change if you don't check them, because you might be acting off of them without realizing. So I would encourage folks to really do that hard inner work.
Definitely.
Well, I just want to, you know, wrap it up by saying, you know, thank you, first off, for bringing us all together, because this is like a hard conversation to have. And, you know, I want to thank the other guests, like you guys, definitely, like, thank you for making this you know, open space to be able to talk, and we could be honest with each other without, you know, the guns and knives coming out. You know what I mean? So I thought that was really cool. And yeah, man, you know, I'd also like to say, because I know that we were supposed to talk about it, but we didn't. Nobody in the black community is co-signing that bullshit that's happening with the street vendors. So it's important that, you know, everybody in the brown community understand that nobody is out here supporting that. And if we catch them before you do, we might whoop their asses. So it's one of those things where we not okay with it. It's no different than what our grandparents would be if they were out there doing the same work. And we just not with it. And to black people, you know, I just encourage you who are listening, you got to focus on building your community. You know, first and foremost, you got to do the work. It's hard. It's not easy. It's not glamorous. Nobody's going to give you an award, put you on TV for it. But you will make yourself and your family better if you focus on what you got to do first before chasing what the media is telling you to chase, because they're telling you to chase something that they know you'll never be able to catch, versus in your own community, you can control the outcomes that are happening around you.
Mark your calendars for the summer 2020 session of Music for LA at the Whitehall Arts Academy. Choose from piano, guitar, violin, drums, singing, as well as stage and dance lab for children ages 4 through 17. Private lessons are also available in all instruments, as well as singing for children and adults. Due to COVID-19 precautions, classes will be on Zoom. Instruments are also available for rent upon request. Enroll now at whitehallacademy.org/musicforla. You can also reach Tanisha Hall, who is the director of Whitehall Arts Academy, at 424-235-0665. This is a black-owned arts academy in South Central for the youth. So make sure you tap in.